This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, KDLG's weekly news magazine. It's Friday, July 8th. I'm your host, Dave Benninger. Thanks for joining us. Coming up this week, we'll go looking for that milestone salmon.
Okay, looks like Emma got fish 2 billion. You may have to be 2 billion in one.
I didn't know that's fish 2 billion. What if I had? What if that was...
Someone caught the 2 billion salmon in this fishery's history on Wednesday. Pretty impressive. Two scientists at a remote post on Bristol Bay's northwest coast watched helplessly as a stranded gray whale, cow, and calf died slowly over 12 agonizing days.
It took my breath away. It made me very nauseous when I would see the suffering that these animals were enduring.
They share how nature takes its brutal toll. Plus, a paralytic shellfish poisoning case was reported out of the Chignecks. We'll get more on that. And we'll hear how a kid from rural Maine became a walking encyclopedia of the history and culture of the Lake Clark, Lake Iliamna region.
You know, there's all kinds of hidden dangers lurking. When you're all by yourself, you're extra careful, or you should be, because otherwise you're not going to survive. And, well, here I am.
Those stories are coming up after a look back at some of the week's news. The Bristol Bay commercial sockeye fishery seems on the brink of going big this weekend. Catches Thursday were more than 1.6 million bay wide, and following strong catch days at the Port Moeller test fishery this week, it looks like things are shaping up. The total run is now 16.5 million out of an estimated 45 to 51 million sockeye. The University of Washington Fisheries Research Institute says there's a 95% probability that the run is coming in close to forecast, but anywhere from 2 to 8 days late, similar to 2015. By many measures, the fishery is off to a good, steady start. The Ugashic District has had good harvests, and area manager Paul Solomon says no problems so far with new nearby wildlife.
You know, so far I haven't had any complaints or phone calls from any walrus, so I'm going to take that as being okay. As far as I know, everybody's happy with the distances that we've kept, and I haven't heard anybody complain about it.
On Wednesday this week, the season total harvest passed 10,033,000 salmon, meaning the 2 billionth commercially caught salmon had been landed since the fishery's inception in 1884. Further out, the Area M North Peninsula fleet went on processor catch limits Tuesday after the Peter Pan facility said it had more harvest than it could handle. Fish and Game's area manager Bob Murphy in Port Moeller offered an update Tuesday, saying the run had seen a steady build out there.
The last actually 10 days or so, things have kind of picked up on the north side dramatically. So, and it's been kind of gradual, and the catches have been pretty strong. So, and that's kind of what instituted the limits for the one shore-based processor we have here on the north side. And essentially that things are starting to pick up in the bay and potentially exporting capacity to King Cove from Port Moeller is kind of getting limited, and those are some of the factors.
In other news, efforts are getting underway to improve the access roads to the Wood River Bridge that was completed last fall near Aleknagik. Sean Baskey is DOT's project manager for phases 2 and 3 of the project.
Phase 1 just constructed the bridge and a little bit of connection into some local streets. And then phase 2 will, you know, improve that roadway, the existing roadways out there, and then provide a much better connection.
Local contractor Ming Enterprises was awarded the $6.3 million contract for phase 2. Last night, the U.S. Senate passed a bill that is said to require consumer labeling of genetically modified foods, but opponents say it is too weak to be called a requirement. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski says the legislation would not obligate the makers of genetically engineered salmon to clearly distinguish their product from a natural salmon.
The reality is we will not see the labeling that I, as an Alaskan, who is putting fish on the dinner table for my family, that I would require, that I would want.
The bill would allow GMO food manufacturers to satisfy the mandate by placing a QR code on their labels. The measure passed the Senate by a vote of 63 to 30. It now goes to the House. Next year, Dillingham will have a new Superior Court judge. Pat Douglas will be retiring. Suzanne DiPietro is the executive director of Alaska's Judicial Council.
Judge Douglas, as you know, has had a long and excellent career out in the Dillingham area, and she let the Judicial Council know that she intends to retire in 2017. So she is not standing for retention. She has announced that she will not be standing for retention.
She says the council will interview applicants and hold public hearings in Dillingham before making a recommendation to the governor for the next judge. Pat Douglas took over after Fred Teresi retired in December 2011. This week, authorities suspended the search for a missing man in Nome. A week-long effort had turned up no clues on the whereabouts of Joseph Balderas, a 36-year-old who went hiking alone the weekend of June 26th. Family and friends say they will continue if funding allows. Governor Bill Walker faces a potential campaign to recall him from office. The effort is backed by Joe Miller, the runner-up in the 2010 U.S. Senate campaign and 2014 Senate Republican primary. Miller cites Walker's veto of half of permanent fund dividend funding and explaining why he supports ousting the governor before Walker's term ends.
Cutting the people's money before really much substance in anything else. The fact that he misrepresented what he was going to do when he ran for office. Basically his devotion to basically the crony capitalist interests in the state as opposed to the people's interests, I think, fall squarely within the recall parameters.
State law provides for four grounds for recall: lack of fitness, incompetence, neglect of duties, or corruption. The recall application must have nearly 29,000 signatures to start the formal recall petition process. And despite some hype this week, Senator Dan Sullivan says he's not interested in running as Donald Trump's vice presidential candidate.
I can tell you this, I have not been contacted by the Trump campaign personally on this. What I can tell you is I was in a meeting with Donald Trump and a number of my Republican colleagues, which I thought went well, but it went well in particular because I had the chance to talk to him after the meeting about an issue that I think most Alaskans are focused on, and that's our economy and energy.
People magazine wrote a piece speculating that Sullivan might be tapped for the ticket. More on this week's news can be found at our website, kdlg.org. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. I'm Dave Benninger. Do you remember when Bob King, veteran of KDLG and avid fish historian, told us this last November?
Since the canned salmon industry came to Bristol Bay in 1884, fishermen have landed 1.99 billion salmon, 93% of which were sockeye.
He penned a nice essay positing that this would be the year that the commercial fishery in Bristol Bay would cross the 2 billionth salmon milestone. King told us he'd been quietly watching the numbers, and when Fish and Game published their preseason forecast, he knew this would be the year.
It took 95 years for Bristol Bay to produce its first billion salmon. The 2 billionth fish will come just 38 years after that. That 1 billionth salmon was caught on the afternoon of June 28, 1978, in the Nooshigak.
Well, the magic number to hit this year was 10 million. 33,455, according to Fish and Game records. All indicators were that salmon would be caught in someone's gill net on Wednesday, which proved aptly cloudy, cool, and rainy. I headed down to Kanakanak Beach to see what some set netters had to say about it.
So the 2 billionth salmon's going to get caught today.
We caught it this morning, about 2 o'clock.
This is Coffee Point Setner Corey Evans with a common response to that question. He also offered reflections on the fishery and the milestone that were shared by many Wednesday as well.
It's impressive it's gone on for this long, and I think it says something about the management that we can keep it going like this. That, you know, it's not, you see a lot of fisheries that have trouble and through the years, and this one seems to be going pretty strong, so it's really nice to see.
How'd that 2 billionth one look this morning?
Big.
Steve Becker is also a set netter who was getting ready to launch for the afternoon's opener.
The what?
The 2 billionth salmon.
Really?
In the fishery's commercial history.
In the history of,
gonna
really.
Caught today. Any thoughts?
I'm going to catch it.
How do you know it'll be you?
How does anybody know who it's going to be? It's going to be me.
Whoever catches the 2 billionth salmon next year will never be known. Fishing will probably be fast and furious when next year's catch tops 9.5 million. Anyone could claim credit for catching the 2 billionth salmon. And everyone should.
Kyle Blecken down on Coffee Point.
2 billionth fish is going to get caught somewhere in Bristol Bay today. Thoughts?
Yeah, we're going to catch that. Then we're going to mount it, frame it. Sell it on eBay. I don't know. We'll do something with it.
Maybe you'll get a better price than 50 cents a pound for it.
Hopefully.
Well, good luck, and what do you think that says about the bay?
Well, it's an ecological wonder. I mean, it's a magnificent display of you know, the bounty of just raw nature, and it's, you know, it's the last great salmon run on Earth, and it's worth protecting. And congratulations to everybody who's been involved in protecting that thing for over the last 100 years, and it says a lot about this wonderful place we get to live in and call home.
Wednesday afternoon, salmon were picked from gill nets in Ugashik, Igigik, Naknek-Quidjak, Togiak, Igushik, and Nushigak. The milestone fish came from somewhere, anywhere, in the bay. Matt Shawcroft and his four kids put their net in the water just after 2 p.m. Maybe they caught it.
That'll be most of you.
Mom. No, this is serious business here.
Come on, James, you want to make me famous or what?
So we are picking the 2 billionth fish in Bristol Bay. Okay, today, any one of these fish that we pick could possibly be fish number 2 billion. So this is a special day in Bristol Bay. You guys ready to pick the net?
Yeah!
Yes!
Okay, let's get it over the bow.
Now, fishing has been slow for Coffee Point set netters so far this season, but the Shawcroft net had 100 pounds or more in it just after they stretched it off from shore. And generations 2 and 3 of Shawcroft set netters began picking those fish out.
Okay, looks like Emma got fish 2 billion. You may have to be 2 billion and one.
I didn't know that's fish 2 billion. What if I had? What if that was fish 9 million? 999?
Sockeye came in the boat one after the next and right into the icy brine of the Shawcroft's fish holds. The rain turned from a drizzle to a downpour. A perfect Bristol Bay July afternoon. All right, James, so we hit 2 billion today. You picked out one of those. What are the odds you'll be here to pick the 3 billionth?
576 to 1.
You want to stick with this business long enough to be around to pick the 3 billionth in another 30 years?
I don't know.
But I bet you'd be glad to know that it will be there, right?
Yeah, I know it'll be there. But I don't know if I'm the one who's going to pick it.
I'll be the one who will pick it.
How do you know it's not me?
The milestone salmon could have been a king, chum, maybe a pink, not likely a coho. But the overwhelming odds are that it was a Bristol Bay sockeye. It was probably sold to a tender or driven up a beach and given to a processor. From there, it might be canned, frozen head and gutted, filleted, or put fresh on a plane. A little later in the evening Wednesday, Icicle Wood River plant manager Samantha Russell showed me the fish.
So we're standing here on the sorting line at the Icicle Seafoods Wood River plant. And my name is Samantha, and I'm pleased to announce that I'm holding the 2 billionth sockeye salmon we harvested out of Bristol Bay.
Tell me about this guy in particular. That's a good-looking fish.
It sure is. That's about I would say that's about a 10-pound round fish here. 100% scales, firm, number one quality.
Where will this end up?
Quite honestly, we're going to pack this fresh and fly it out on Alaska Airlines tomorrow. And this fish will wind up somewhere on the East Coast.
Went out fresh.
Flying out fresh.
So the 2 billionth Bristol Bay salmon is going to be on somebody's dinner table this week.
It should be on somebody's dinner table probably by tomorrow evening.
With continued scientific management of the salmon resource, maintaining the fish's natural habitat, and a little good luck, Bristol Bay fishermen might look forward to catching its 3 billionth salmon in 2054. Good luck and good fishing.
This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, back in a moment. An incident of paralytic shellfish poisoning was reported out of the Chignecks this week. PSP is a serious illness caused by eating contaminated shellfish. The toxins can be 1,000 times more potent than cyanide, and the toxin levels contained in just a single shellfish can be fatal to humans. PSP can come from all bivalve shellfish, like clams, mussels, oysters, geoducks, and scallops. To find out more what happened in this case and more about PSP in general, I'm joined now by Dr. Michael Cooper. Cooper is the state's infectious disease program manager. Doctor, it's good to speak with you. We never seem to speak on occasions that have good news, unfortunately, but news this week that there were possibly some cases of paralytic shellfish poisoning out of the Chignix area. What can you tell us about this so far? I know that these investigations take a little time to get to the bottom of.
Yeah, we're in the middle of this investigation. So, you know, unfortunately, this year already, we've had numerous reports across the state of suspect cases of paralytic shellfish poisoning. We get these every year. We've had a few more than usual this year from different places. But, you know, over the weekend, we did get a report of a couple of individuals who sought care with possible symptoms of paralytic shellfish poisoning. So, and like I said, we're in the middle of this investigation, but what we found out is that some butter clams were likely harvested around that area the day before, and then they were consumed by a couple of individuals. They were actually also consumed with a group of over probably 15 people, and an undetermined amount developed some really early on kind of numbness and tingling of their mouth and tongue. And for most of those people in that group, the symptoms resolved pretty quickly. But for a couple, they did progress to the point where they had to go and seek medical care, and which is, you know, what we advise. You know, we advise that, unfortunately, in Alaska, you know, beaches are not monitored for paralytic shellfish poisoning, unfortunately. And so it can never be considered safe to consume, you know, personally and recreationally harvested shellfish. But if you do, and we know a lot of people do, to know the symptoms and to know to go in and seek care immediately if you develop them. Because for most people, they get what, you know, most of the people who consumed this past weekend get, which is pretty minor symptoms of maybe some numbness, maybe some tingling around your mouth or lips. But for a smaller percentage, they can actually be develop into life-threatening symptoms, and there have been deaths associated with paralytic shellfish poisoning in the past. Fortunately, not many. So, you know, these people did what is recommended. If you get those symptoms, you seek care. And fortunately, you know, we're in the middle of the investigation, but fortunately reports are that they are improved at this point.
All right. Are there any telltale signs that people might avoid? Was there some sort of an algae bloom? Is there anything that you can tell on Alaska beaches, whether or not you're in an area of safe bivalves to pick and consume?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I'd first say that commercially harvested shellfish go through testing and are considered safe. But, you know, in terms of personally or recreationally harvested shellfish, you know, people want to look at any kind of signs that, you know, this might be safer, or a safer day of the week, or a safer month of the year, or the water looks different and it might be safer to consume. And unfortunately, nothing is reliable. We've had reports of likely PSP in every month of the year. You can get shellfish with the toxin, the saxitoxin, when there's an algae bloom and when there's not. Sometimes shellfish can pick up and keep the toxin during an algae bloom and keep it there for very, very long periods of time when the water has since, you know, gotten clearer again. So, you know, unfortunately, there's just, in the absence of testing those shellfish or having the beaches testing, there's not a reliable way to do that. And so, you know, every time that you recreationally harvest and consume those shellfish, although the risk is low, there is that definite risk that it could cause paralytic shellfish poisoning for you.
Dr. Michael Cooper is the infectious disease program manager with the state of Alaska. Dr. Cooper, thanks so much.
Thanks, David. I sure appreciate it.
Michael Moran, known during my youth in Bristol Bay as Mike. raised in Dillingham, conceived in Dillingham, raised in Dillingham my early years. And I fished at on the beach at Ecuc since 1955. One thing that I am required to do by law is to tell the truth. I'm a member of California State Bar, so being an officer of the court, I can't suborn perjury or anything like that. Now, while it's a well-known fact that the way you can tell if a fisherman's lying to you is if his lips are moving, I can't participate in any of that at all. I just have to report the facts as they come along. So it was a red salmon. It scaled in at 7 pounds. It was a male. We had some witnesses there with the crew, and there was Ecuc Fisheries personnel on site to verify this. Just a beautiful specimen of the red salmon. We were able to identify it in the outer portion of the net as it came in, maintained its dignity there. Somewhere along the way in the school, it had lost its sign identifying itself specifically as such, but this fish was just a radiant example of a Bristol Bay sockeye male. That particular fish is listed as a special line item delivery on fish ticket number B11077117. I think that pretty well, cinches the claim. And numerous people have witnessed it. The fish was kissed. It was handled separately. I, of course, delivered it because I'm required to do that. I don't care whether I'm paid for it or not. I'm terribly honored by the fact and humbled to know that I was able to catch him. I asked them to donate the fish to science. There may be some benefit to the fishery by looking at such a monumental fish as this was.
The natural world around us here is wonderful and raw, and surely it's a privilege to be reminded of just how so once in a while. But two scientists posted at Cape Pierce on Bristol Bay's northwest coast this summer witnessed nature take its toll more than they may have wanted. Lisa Andriano and Mike Walgren are biologists with California State Parks and have spent the past 14 summers volunteering for seabird research in Alaska. Alone at Cape Pierce for 2 weeks, they watched helplessly as a stranded gray whale cow and calf died a slow, brutal death over 12 days. I spoke with Lisa Andriano by phone and asked her to relay the story, beginning with the morning they discovered the whales after a short hike from the cabin up a sandy dune that overlooks the mouth of the bay.
And we noticed something huge and out of place on the beach. And sure enough, when we got there, it was an adult gray whale that had beached out on a sandy shoal at Maggie Beach, probably came in on the high tide feeding. And we looked kind of around and we saw a calf that was way up the beach towards the inlet of the bay. So we went and checked the calf out, and they seemed to be breathing and moving their tails and moving their bodies and their mouths around. The baby was vocalizing, the mom wasn't. And we decided at that point that we would call Fish and Wildlife Service and find out what they wanted us to do.
Unfortunately, there was nothing that could be done. The Togiak Refuge contacted NOAA, which has jurisdiction over and often assets to help with stranded whales. But Cape Pierce is remote, and NOAA staff were busy with other dead whales elsewhere in the state. Andriano and Walgren were advised to try and keep the animals wet and cool and wait until the next high tide, which would hopefully float them off.
That's what we did. We went back and we got shovels and buckets and blankets and sheets, and we basically just continued to bucket them down with cold seawater, covered them with blankets, keeping those blankets wet to kind of protect their skin and just to keep them moist so they didn't overheat.
They also tried to dig around the whales, hoping to get them in a little more water or give them more wiggle room. That was day one. But the tides were getting smaller each day, which sealed the whales' fate. High water came up again, and the whales stayed beached.
We tried for multiple days during the high tide to push them, and there was just no getting these whales free. they were just too stuck, and there wasn't enough water. As I mentioned, the tides were going down. That went on for quite a few days until we realized that there was no way we were going to be able to get them out. And at that point, we were pretty much directed to just kind of let nature take its course.
The agonizing days ticked by. Gray whales migrate from the Baja Peninsula, where this calf was born last winter, up to the Bering or Chukchi Seas to feed in these shallow coastal waters for the summer. Death was coming for this pair, but not on Mercy's clock. Andriano and Walgren sat guard at night, chasing off predators, and helped cool the whales during the unseasonably hot days. For maybe the first week, Andriano says the animals were able to defend themselves against birds and foxes by wiggling and opening their mouths.
The mama was alive for about 10 days, and the baby was alive for about 12 days before she finally died. And they got worse over time. You know, their skin started to crack and peel, and the birds started to peck at them. And the more they deteriorated, the more other animals started taking advantage of them, which is all nature. It's all part of it. But it was hard to observe that and not be able to do anything to help them.
The scientists wrestled with two questions. First, should they put these whales out of their misery? Andriano says that was what they both desperately wanted to do, but federal law is strict and clear that these gray whales could not be killed. That is, unless Alaska Natives took them for subsistence. Nearby villages were contacted, but there was little interest in hazarding the journey to Cape Pierce to salvage the whales. The second question on their minds was, unable to kill the stranded, suffering animals, were their efforts to comfort and protect them perhaps the wrong thing to do?
Is it better for us to just let nature take its course and hopefully they'll die sooner than later? Are we just prolonging their misery by protecting their skin? I mean, these are conversations that we had, and we went round and around until we both felt like the best thing to do at a certain point was to just back off.
Had this location been nearer to town, a boat or bulldozer might have moved the whales off the beach. Had they been dolphins, Andriano and Walgren might have saved them. As it was, they realized they were witness to a scene that would be playing out whether they were there or not, and is probably repeated often along Alaska's 34,000 miles of shoreline. That was the rational thinking, but Andriano says the 12 days were an emotional and gut-wrenching experience. Like finding the carcasses of bull moose interlocked by their antlers, nature reminds us that some lives end badly.
It's beautiful and it's brutal, right? That's what nature is. There's so much beauty, and that place is so beautiful and it's so remote. And this is just part of the food chain out there, and you can have that conversation with yourself logically, but being a human wanting to help, it's very difficult.
On day 10, the mother finally died, and ironically, the tide that day climbed back high enough to float and carry away her carcass. The calf died 2 days later, just as the high waters began to reach its body as well. Andriano and Walgren boarded a plane that day, July 4th, back to Dillingham. They carried with them carefully documented notes on the slow decay of two stranded live gray whales, hoping something useful might come of it. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, back in a moment. Thanks for staying with us. Finally, this week, for the last 30 years, John Branson has been studying and writing about Bristol Bay's history from his office at Lake Clark National Park. Branson has published 11 books, including The Life and Times of John W. Clark of Nooshigak and 2 volumes of Dick Pernicki's journals. Soon, this historian will hang up his hat, at least officially. KDLG's Hannah Colton visited Branson at his Port Allsworth cabin last week and has this story.
John Branson just got back from Anchorage with a box of fresh peaches.
Amy, where'd the ice cream go to?
He's invited some Park Service friends over for pie, and everyone marvels at the crust, baked slightly crispy in his big wood-burning stove.
You know, got a nice oven. There's all kinds of pie spilling juice that I've got to get out of there. I can heat my whole place with this most of the time. But
living in a cabin like this was Branson's dream ever since he was a little kid growing up in a small town near Portland, Maine. He got the Alaska bug, as he says, on a trip to Southeast at the age of 12. So after college, he took a job as a high school teacher in Naknek. The teaching gig didn't last. The school board didn't like him voicing his opinions on the Vietnam War. So for the next couple years, Branson worked at a cannery and wintered at a hunting camp on the Alaska Peninsula outside Port Hyden.
And I enjoyed it immensely and learned a lot. And you have to really have your wits about you, you know, so you don't drown or you don't cut yourself with an axe or you don't accidentally shoot your foot off, or, you know, there's all kinds of hidden dangers lurking. When you're all by yourself, you're extra careful, or you should be, because otherwise you're not going to survive. And, well, here I am.
Branson not only survived, but with his hard work, made himself indispensable to people he met. Up on Lake Clark in 74, he was asked to caretake the homestead of former Alaska Governor Jay and Bella Hammond. That's also where Branson met Dick Prenicky, the famed homesteader who built a cabin up at Twin Lakes. The two would go hiking together, occasionally work on projects.
Learned a lot from Prenicky. Sharp guy, tireless. I never saw him, you know, get tired.
Throughout all these years, being mostly alone, Branson was always a historian at heart. He had an excellent memory and kept journals. After 10 years at the Hammonds, Branson gave in to suggestions by his father and by Jay Hammond that he take a position with the National Park Service. He moved to Port Allsworth and, with a friend, built the small cabin he still lives in.
You know, I've got different books. I've got some on Alaska.
Now it's filled with maps and books about baseball and American history.
This is the definitive edition of Lewis and Clark.
He says it's accounts like this that helped inspire some of his own work. One expedition Branson chronicled is the tale of McNabb and Vreeland, two New Yorkers who came to Lake Clark to hunt sheep in 1921. And at 69 years old now, Branson is an encyclopedia of late 19th century, early 20th century Lake Clark and its residents. Those people, both Alaska Native and later settlers, are the people who inspired his life's work. Throughout his career, Branson would actually try to recreate their journeys. For example, he heard about one Dena'ina man, Trifon Beluda, who'd hiked 50 miles to pick up some provisions.
And he, in the summertime, he could come down to Keejik to try to get some more tea and sugar, and he would walk it in one day. So I tried to do that, and I got it. Came close. I like that idea of empathizing with, thinking about how the people in the older generations did things and then trying to do it similar to them so you get the same feeling that they had when they were out on the land. Anyway, I thought that would help me enhance my abilities as a historian to, you know, to try to experience what they might have experienced.
Do you think you've been successful in that?
I think at times I have been, yeah. I felt the same things that some of the old Native people felt when they were walking across the land.
Branson was still doing those marathon hikes up until last year, when Harold came into the picture. Harold is what he jokingly calls the pouch connected to his abdomen, a kind of external gut that's the result of Crohn's disease. His symptoms are in check now, but he needs to be closer to doctors, which is why he's retiring and moving back to Maine. But Branson doesn't have any plans to slow down. He says he wants to explore New England, get into archaeology, teach kids about climate change, and spend some time in France. He says he likes the culture.
No, I like the 2-hour lunches and 3 or 4 hour dinners, that kind of stuff.
Oh, and he plans to write a couple more books. Reporting in Port Allsworth, I'm Hannah Colton.
And I'm Dave Bittinger, and that's it for this week's show. You can find this and past episodes of Bristol Bay and Beyond at our website, kdlg.org. Keep in touch with your feedback and those ideas. dave@kdlg.org, or call us here at the station anytime, 842-5281. My thanks to Molly Dishner, Spencer Tordoff, Shaylin Cochran, and Hannah Colton, the whole news crew here at Public Radio for Alaska's Bristol Bay. I'm Dave Bittinger. We'll see you back here next week.